is Friday, October 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a global pandemic with no clear end in sight.
All the indicators we have are that things are going in the wrong direction.
EU leaders enact tough sanctions over the assassination attempt on Vladimir Putin critic Alexei Navalny.
Among those on the sanctions list are members of Russian President Putin's inner circle.
Also had a tearjerker performance by John Legend at the Billboard Music Awards. It's all on today's International Edition. Coronavirus cases around the world have climbed to all-time highs, with over 38 million cases and a death toll exceeding 1.8 million as of Wednesday. The surges are forcing many places to reimpose tough restrictions eased just months ago. The United States remains the worst-hit country in the world, followed by India and Brazil. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
Health Organization says many countries are reporting an increase in coronavirus hospitalizations. At the same time, the WHO says it's been an uneven pandemic because of how countries have responded and how they've been affected.
Almost 70% of all cases reported globally last week were from 10 countries, and almost half of all cases were from just 3 countries.
The WHO Director General also said while there has been some discussion about the concept of herd immunity by letting the virus spread, he is not in favor of it.
Herd immunity is a concept used for vaccination, in which a population can be protected from a certain virus if a threshold of vaccination is reached. For example, herd immunity against measles requires about 95% of a population to be vaccinated. For polio, the threshold is about 80%. In other words, herd immunity is achieved by protecting people from a virus, not by exposing them to it.
Meanwhile, in the U.S., the country with the most coronavirus cases, election campaigning is in full swing weeks before the November 3rd contest. President Trump is back on the campaign trail after contracting the virus about 2 weeks ago. His Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, continues to criticize Trump's handling of the pandemic.
Folks, Donald Trump's chaotic and divisive leadership has cost us far too much. 215,000 dead from COVID-19 and rising.
Trump insists better days lie ahead.
Right now, I'm fighting to eradicate the virus, rebuild the economy, and save our country from the radical left.
This week, Johnson & Johnson said it was pausing clinical trials of a COVID-19 vaccine due to an unexplained illness in a study participant. Drug maker Eli Lilly said it was also halting its coronavirus antibody trial because of safety concerns. Meanwhile, hopes for passing a new coronavirus relief package faded as U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected the White House's $1.8 trillion proposal. Delays are prompting anxiety in financial markets, according to analysts.
I think investors are frustrated that Washington can't seem to get its act together to give a package to the country, which is sorely needed, especially for small business, before the election.
In Europe, France has recently seen record numbers of confirmed COVID-19 cases, prompting President Emmanuel Macron to impose a nighttime curfew for Paris and several other cities. In Spain, where the number of cases is higher than anywhere else in Western Europe, emotional fatigue has set in among some of the intensive care staff. In Britain, London's mayor warns of tougher coronavirus restrictions as cases rise.
I'm afraid the bad news is that all the indicators we have, the number of new cases, the positivity rate, admissions to hospitals, admissions in ICUs, cases of older people, all the indicators we have are that things are going in the wrong direction.
Restrictions include a 6-person limit on social gatherings and a 10 p.m. curfew in pubs, clubs, and restaurants. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
U.S. President Donald Trump's nominee to fill the vacancy left on the U.S. Supreme Court by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg last month cleared her first hurdle for confirmation this week. In 4 marathon hearing days, Barrett deflected questions on how she would rule on issues from abortion to the election to gun rights. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on the next steps in the process.
a preview of the fight to come.
I'm not going to sit on the sidelines and watch one of our nominees be destroyed after showing respect for two Democratic nominees. That is not right.
Democrats objecting as President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett moves forward just a few weeks before the election.
This nomination at this moment in time is not usual, not normal, and it's beneath the dignity of this committee. We should have played by the rules.
During two marathon days of questioning, Barrett offered few insights on how she would rule on cases impacting millions of Americans.
I can't take policy positions or express my personal views before the committee because my personal views don't have anything to do with how I would decide cases.
Drawing praise from Republicans for her judicial philosophy.
You got a lifetime appointment, and if you do lawmaking, we can't vote you out of office.
And frustration from Democrats who say if Barrett is seated, she could be the deciding vote on an upcoming case that could dismantle the Affordable Care Act.
Health care coverage for millions of Americans is at stake with this nomination.
But first, the Supreme Court could be asked to rule on disputes related to millions of absentee ballots.
If she decides in the president's favor in any election-related dispute, it's going to cause grievous harm to both the court and indeed our democracy.
Polling shows a slight majority of voters think the nomination should wait until after the election on November 3rd. But as the American public has learned more about Barrett, a mother of seven and devout Catholic, support for her nomination has grown. With early voting already underway, the confirmation hearing could have an impact on voters' decisions.
There's few issues that unite Republicans, like the Supreme Court justice or the right to the restriction of abortion rights. Roe v. Wade and the conservative judges have been a huge staple for Republican platforms, including President Trump's. But on the Democratic side, especially with the vulnerability and the passing of who we just lost with Justice Ginsburg, this is an incredibly motivating factor for them as well.
Democrats acknowledge Barrett's nomination will almost certainly pass the Republican majority U.S. Senate.
I don't come out of this for the cries of defeat. You know why? Because it's motivating more people to vote. You chose to do it in the middle of election, so let's all go out there and vote.
The Senate Judiciary Committee returns next Monday to prepare Barrett's nomination for a full floor vote the week of October 26. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern is expected to return to power in Saturday's general election. Ms. Ardern has been praised globally for her response to the Christchurch mosque attacks in 2019 and the COVID-19 pandemic, but critics point to her coalition government's failure to tackle child poverty. Phil Mercer has more from Sydney.
Jacinda Ardern is the type of leader New Zealand has never seen before. She has several million social media followers and won global acclaim for her sensitivity after a gunman murdered 51 people at two mosques in the city of Christchurch last year. A swift response to the threat of COVID-19 has also attracted widespread praise. Ms. Ardern's centre-left Labour Party came to power in 2017, even though it lost the election. Under New Zealand's proportional representation voting system, it managed to put together a coalition with a small group of nationalist lawmakers and the Green Party. Her main challenger in Saturday's poll is a seasoned politician nicknamed Crusher Collins. When the leader of the Conservative National Party, Judith Collins, was the police minister in a previous government, she supported a policy to crush the cars of repeat traffic offenders. She's clashed with Ms. Ardern during the campaign, calling the Prime Minister a liar over testing protocols for COVID-19 at New Zealand's closed international borders. Political commentator Ben Thomas told Radio New Zealand that personal insults won't sway voters.
This kind of language doesn't come from a position of strength. It's an attempt to provoke Ardern into responding to Collins, you know, putting the spotlight on a confrontation between those two leaders, and, yeah, trying to make National seem a little bit more relevant in the dying days of an election that they certainly don't look on track to win.
Much of the campaign has been around New Zealand's response to COVID-19. The government's decision to close its international borders to foreign nationals in March and a series of strict domestic lockdowns appear to have been well received by voters, although the virus has pushed the nation into recession. New Zealand has had about 1,800 coronavirus infections and 25 deaths. Analysts have said the pandemic has helped the Ardern government avoid greater scrutiny over its failures to reduce child poverty and build more affordable housing. The South Pacific nation adopted the German-style mixed-member proportional voting system in 1996. That's led to coalition governments ever since. Seven seats are reserved for indigenous Maori candidates in the 120-seat national parliament. About 3.5 million people are expected to vote in Saturday's poll. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
European Union leaders met in person for the first of a two-day summit on Thursday to discuss topics ranging from Brexit to climate change to relations with Africa. The meetings came the same day EU sanctions went into full effect against six Russian individuals and one entity believed to be involved in the assassination attempt on Vladimir Putin critic Alexei Navalny. Joining us from Paris is journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, we've been hearing Navalny has been recovering very well after being poisoned with a toxic nerve agent back in August. Still, EU leaders have definitely not forgotten. What can you tell us about the sanctions?
The European Union sanctions against the six comes just 2 weeks after EU leaders condemned the attack on Navalny as an assassination attempt and said it was a serious breach of international law. Now, among those on the sanctions list are members of Russian President Putin's inner circle, including the head of Russia's Federal Security Service, two deputy ministers of defense, and an envoy of the Russian president to Siberia. They'll have their assets frozen and will be subject to a travel ban to the EU with immediate effect. The EU has also imposed sanctions on the Russian State Research Institute of Organic Chemistry and Technology, which the EU says developed the nerve agent used to poison Mr. Navalny.
And Catherine, the announcement of these sanctions came as European Union leaders were meeting in Brussels. And I know that among the items on the agenda was climate change. Observers really had been hoping that the EU leaders would back a 55% cut in greenhouse emissions by 2030, but it doesn't seem like they were able to agree on that. The EU had been a leader in climate change. Why were they unable to agree on this?
There had been a hope that France and Germany and the EU executive could somehow push the other leaders into agreeing to that ambitious cut in greenhouse gas emissions of at least 55% by 2030. At the moment, the target is a 40% reduction, although the European Parliament is calling on countries in the bloc to go further and introduce a 60% cut in CO2 emissions compared to 1990. However, to get this agreement, they needed all 27 member states to agree, and they can't get that. In the main, because many of the Eastern European members, such as Poland, depend on coal for energy. So now any decision on emission targets will be put off until at least December. And between now and then, there'll be talks with those members to try and find some sort of solution.
And EU leaders are meeting again today for the second of this two-day summit with plans to discuss relations between the 27-member bloc and the Africa Union. Of course, an EU-African summit had been scheduled for earlier this year, but it was canceled due to the pandemic. So what initiatives or proposals can we expect to come from this meeting?
We're still waiting for a new date for that EU-African Union summit to be put forward. Many EU nations are struggling to contain coronavirus, so it seems unlikely a physical meeting of the 55 African Union and 27 European Union heads of state could be arranged in the near future. However, this does not mean the EU is ignoring Africa. It's on the agenda to be discussed when leaders convene Friday morning, as well as trade, development, security, and counterterrorism. There is also the question of the economic consequences of COVID. Already, you're seeing pressure on leaders in some countries, particularly in North Africa, as their economies are struggling. And as a result, there's a risk of a new wave of irregular migration into the European Union. That's of particular concern to the big members, such as Spain, Italy, and France.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thanks so much. As the fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani forces rages on in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, its residents are joining volunteer squads to defend their towns. The fighting broke out on September 27th and has been the biggest escalation of a decades-old conflict over the region, which lies within Azerbaijan but has been under control of ethnic Armenian forces backed by Armenia. Joining us now from the Armenian capital of Yerevan is VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch. Heather, what are you hearing from the war zone about what's been happening on the ground?
Well, the battles are continuing, and there's still bombing and reports of civilian towns and cities getting attacked continuously, reports from both sides and conflicting reports sometimes. Other than that, there is some areas that looks like might have changed hands, but it's still not quite clear who's in charge there at the moment. And it seems to be shaping up to look a little bit like a stalemate, like nobody's moving anywhere.
Except the fighting continues. Is it getting worse?
I wouldn't say it's getting worse, but it has been so heavy and so rough in the recent days that it's hard to imagine it would get worse.
Are you hearing anything for how civilians are coping or how this is impacting them? We've been hearing a lot about multiple continuing fatalities and displacement and people just looking to stay alive.
Yes, they say by some estimates, about half the population of Nagorno-Karabakh has been displaced, and that's about 75,000 people. For the most part, they've been displaced into hotels and people's houses. A lot of people around the country are hosting people who are displaced, who very much say, I've talked to many displaced people, that they're temporarily displaced and they intend to go back. The mood is pretty somber, though, around everywhere I've been, where there's been a lot of fatalities. Everyone seems to know somebody who is fighting. There's a huge amount of mobilization, as I understand on both sides, but I'm only on one, so I can only speak for that. For example, there are collection points for donations for everything from medicine to food to first aid, clothes, anything that volunteers, sort of like a patchwork of volunteers across the country, are trying to deliver to displaced families. And it seems that almost everyone is involved. Like, for example, when you go to pay for something around here, people often say, don't pay me, donate it to the cause. Mm-hmm. So the people here, and as I understand, this is also very true on the other side, seem to have, for lack of a better word, a huge swelling of national pride. They view this war as an existential threat, and that their very existence as people with homeland is threatened by the possible loss of this area. On the other side, what I have heard is that their views are similarly strong in that they believe it's an illegally occupied area and it has been occupied for 30 years. And when that happened, by some estimates, more than 1 million people were displaced. Most of them were Azerbaijanis. And those people, which some people will say number based on the generational gap, more children being born, number close to 1 million people that hold a claim from 30 years ago to this area and they want to go back. So it's very emotional on both sides.
And I would imagine beyond all of these people trying to help one another with food and potential injuries, I wonder what impact this could all have on the spread of coronavirus as well.
There's also a question of the pandemic here and is it spreading in the war zone? We don't know. I don't have any solid information, but there is a bit of a panic here right now about that. People are really worried at the moment. It's so dangerous there that it's not, people aren't thinking of masks and sanitizer and staying apart. People are huddled together in bunkers. So if it spreads a little bit, it's going to spread a lot.
VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch, thanks for being with us. The head of the International Federation Association of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is warning Sudan's fragile political stability could be at risk if the desperate needs of hundreds of thousands of flood victims are not urgently addressed. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Severe floods have affected nearly 900,000 Sudanese people, reportedly killing more than 120, rendering thousands of families homeless and destroying farmlands and livelihoods. Jagan Chapagan is the Secretary General of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, and he has just returned from a four-day assessment mission to Sudan. He says the impact of the worst floods in three decades is far beyond anything he had expected.
I visited an area called Algamayer on the outskirts of Khartoum. Homes, infrastructure, and crops have been destroyed. The conditions are simply appalling. It is boiling hot, more than 40 degrees, and there is no shade. The camp we visited is surrounded by stagnant water and mosquitoes are rife.
Chapagand says the only access to clean water or sanitary toilets is at the neighboring school, which is closed at night. He says people also lack sufficient shelter, toilets, and mosquito nets, which means malaria is rampant and the risk of cholera and other diseases is high. He says children comprise about half of the flood victims and are particularly vulnerable. This humanitarian crisis, he says, also is taking a heavy toll on pregnant and lactating women, the elderly, and disabled. He tells VOA he's very concerned by the level of anger and frustration he encountered and its potential impact on the country's stability.
There was a locust infestation in the beginning of the year. There has been, of course, impact of the COVID. And of course, with the political change, the expectation of the populations and the governments are very, very high, actually extremely high, you could see. But I do believe that the pressure on the government could be very significantly increasing in coming months if these desperate needs are not addressed.
Sudan's transitional government, which took office last year after longtime leader Omar al-Bashir was ousted, is struggling to build a stable political system and end political violence in the impoverished country. The International Red Cross has received just 15% of the $13 million appeal it launched in September to provide health care, shelter, water and sanitation, and other essential relief for 200,000 Sudanese flood victims. Secretary General Chapagan says it is urgent to act now. He warns the failure of the international community to support this life-saving operation will have fearful consequences for many thousands of people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute. VOA.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa News. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. Some tech workers who scrambled to get to San Francisco, California to be near Google, Facebook, Twitter, and the tech ecosystem are now moving to other parts of the U.S. during the pandemic, where the cost of living is much cheaper. Dina Mitchell has the story.
In some ways, 2020 has been kinder to tech workers than others. Most are able to do their jobs remotely. Google said it will be at least July 2021 before workers will be back in the office. Twitter, and now Microsoft, have announced staff may work remotely forever. It is an interesting twist for companies famous for luring employees with their in-office perks that include things like catered lunches, a staff masseuse, and arcade games. Brian Douglas is a tech developer.
I know a lot of people who just really just came just for the job. So
if the job is no longer here and the job's now at home, where you were living in a space that maybe you had like a half kitchen or you were sharing a bathroom, like that kind of gets really awkward when you're inside the house 24/7.
Douglas is a father of two in Oakland, California. Now that his company allows remote work, he is thinking of moving. Douglas said the lack of affordable housing will be the deal breaker for him. He's tried to buy a home here, but in the competitive housing market, he has been outbid. Russell Hancock is the president and CEO of Joint Venture Silicon Valley, an organization that tracks the region's economy and quality of life.
What you have right now in Silicon Valley is this amazing collection of talent, maybe the world's greatest collection of talent. They've come from all over the world. Now that talent is dispersing.
Kyle Dobitz and Mara Van Els are moving out of their modest Silicon Valley apartment, where they have both been working remotely with their two-year-old since March. Dobitz, who works for Google, is transferring to the company's Munich, Germany office, which offers a more affordable cost of living and where places such as parks and museums are more open than the United States. They say unless housing prices drop significantly, they won't move back to the Bay Area, even though they plan to be in Europe just a few years.
We want to be someplace more settled when our kid starts entering primary school. So in 3 years or so, we're kind of going to evaluate where do we want to live for a longer period. And a big part of that will be kind of the affordability of housing.
In the U.S., tech workers are moving to states like Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Texas, places where tech companies have already set up shop. One California woman who moved to Texas in 2017 with her husband's tech job became a real estate agent to help others moving to the Lone Star State. She started a Facebook group called Move to Texas from California, which now has more than 20,000 members. Marie Bailey.
It's just a lot more calm in Texas because it's more affordable. You know, when you live in a more affordable area, it takes a lot of stress off you.
So what does all this migration mean for Silicon Valley? Russell Hancock with Joint Venture Silicon Valley.
We've always thought of Silicon Valley as a phenomenon, this phenomenon of entrepreneurship, innovation, with a particular focus on technology and disruption. And so it could be that Silicon Valley just becomes a brand for all of those things wherever they may be happening.
This makes perfect sense to Douglas, who says techies created the tools to make remote work possible.
Remote work in tech is kind of synonymous. Like all the tools that we're building in the tech industry to make this work, like no reason to have your team in close proximity just to get stuff done.
While there is a desire for things to go back to normal after the pandemic, what normal will look like may be changing in Silicon Valley. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Oakland, California.
And John Legend gave an emotional performance dedicated to his wife at Wednesday's Billboard Music Awards, with his voice aching as he sang passionately from the piano. Legend told viewers, "This is for Chrissy," before singing Never Break. The performance comes just 2 weeks after Chrissy Teigen announced she'd had a miscarriage earlier this month. She wrote a heart-wrenching social media post explaining that she and Legend drove home from the hospital with no baby. Life is hard. We'll never lose our way. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Wunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend.
I'm not worried about us, and I've never been. We know how. We will never break, we will never break. Build on a foundation strong enough to stay. We will never break. As the water rises and the mountains shake, our love will remain. We will never, no, no, never. No, no, never. It's more than a good sensation. It's more than a passing flame. You are the explanation of what love really means. It's bigger than you and me. It's 1 + 1 = 3. When we talk about forever, then forever's what we mean. So I'm not worried about it. And I've never been, no matter what.